Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today was born in Calgary. He's taught biology in a Ghanaian village and wandered through Western and Northern Africa writing an award-winning book about the experience. He spent the millennium in Jerusalem and he's been looking at the connection between Persian poets and traditional wrestlers in Iran. He's written about walls, fences and other hard barriers and the people who live in their shadows. And now he's been to Palestine for his latest book. Marcello D'Assuntio, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you.
Tell me about growing up in Canada, but ending up all over the world.
My city in Canada, Calgary, is really, you know, it's a smallish city where we were a little more than a million now, and we were much less when I was growing up. It was a part of Canada that I didn't grow up thinking about the rest of the world. It was only kind of after university when I noticed that all my friends had been traveling around. And coming back with these great stories and battered backpacks, and I was utterly envious of their experiences. So after graduating from university with a biology degree that I have yet to use, I decided I wanted to do the same sort of thing. So I went off and traveled in Western Africa, teaching biology, as you mentioned, in a Ghanaian village with one of those volunteer abroad outfits. So taught for a few months and then spent a year wandering around Western Africa, almost a full year. I think about 363 days before I came home. And as anyone who does a trip like that, you come home, you're loaded with stories. And I started writing those down, and then that's where the writing happened. I was thinking I was a traveler before I was a writer. Just kind of in love with that, strapping on the backpack and getting out onto the road and getting dusty and dirty and sleeping in dodgy hotels. And I loved it. I still love it.
Sure, but there are many, many travelers out there, and not all of them end up winning an award for their very first book, which is what you did.
Yeah, that was, fair enough. But it's true, though. You know, back then, you know, that first book, you know, there's parts of it that I'm very proud of. But I was a traveler first. If I look at that book now, that's someone who knew how to travel but didn't really know how to write yet. Mm-hmm. And certainly, I think I've become more of a writer as the years have gone by, and the more books and things that I write. As anyone else, you get better as you keep going.
So that book was called Harmattan, Winds Across West Africa, and that, as you say, chronicled your journey backpacking across that part of the world. Now, one thing we didn't mention is that when you were at university, mm-hmm. you were a very keen wrestler.
Very keen might be an exaggeration, but yeah, I did wrestle throughout university. I was on my varsity wrestling team, which is one of the reasons why my grades were so lousy. But I was a student athlete.
But that becomes relevant because, of course, then you go to Iran and you start looking at wrestling and how that feeds into culture there. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it was one of those ideas for a book that I'm surprised the publisher accepted. I really wanted to look at two phenomena, cultural phenomena in Iran. I wanted to look at their adoration for poetry, and especially these old poets from years ago, and as well as their these archaic traditional wrestling styles that they still occasionally competed in. And so I wandered around Iran looking for the tombs of old poets and old wrestlers, and occasionally got on the mat and in the dust with some of these guys and learned some of these weird wrestling styles. And I kind of used the poetry and the wrestling as the engine that ran a travel narrative and that guided me through the country. And it was a fun trip, and I enjoyed myself immensely. And it was a fun way to learn about a people, to actually have them pick you up and throw you on the ground and on purpose. It was a fun time.
Is there a big culture of wrestling there?
Oh, huge, huge. Iran is a world power when it comes to wrestling in the Olympics and the world championships, for sure. But they had these strange folkloric styles where they would wrestle, for example, tied to each other in the dust for the entertainment of wedding guests. Or they would have these strange styles where the poetry would be recited before they would compete to inspire them in their competition. So it was all these very interesting old styles. That was what I was more interested in, was seeking those out. And like everywhere else in the world, there's certain styles that are dying out. You know, there's the traditions that are being lost. And so I was finding what was left of a lot of these weird arcane sports, and it was a riot.
And of course, there's such a huge tradition of poetry,
absolutely,
Persian poetry.
Absolutely. Every Iranian, whether or not he or she's been inside of a classroom in their life, can recite poems off the top of their head. Every taxi driver will recite poetry to you. It's the most remarkably literate place I've ever been, especially when it comes to poetry. That's the highest of the arts in the Middle East in general, but in Iran, it was really the thing to be.
And of course, in between all these trips, you're returning home and you're making a living as a freelance writer.
That's right.
Doing travel pieces mostly?
At the beginning, certainly. A lot of travel pieces. I've kind of expanded my what I write about these days. You know, I write a lot of profiles. I write a lot of just about anything that interests. I've got that. I'm lucky that I have enough outlets that I can write about things that interest me, and I don't have to take a lot of assignments about stories that I'm not that interested in. So I write a lot of profiles, a lot of travel. I have a particular interest in the Middle East, as we'll see, and it's been fun.
You're sounding like it's over.
No, it's not over. Oh, God, I hope not.
Walls. Let's talk about walls.
Sure.
Because Travels Along the Barricades. This was a book for which you visited walls and fences across so many areas of the world. I mean, from Algeria to Belfast.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about the trajectory of that book and how it came about.
Well, you know, it was inspired by my trips to Israel and Palestine. I remember two trips in particular where in 1999 in December, it was the first time I visited Israel and Palestine, and it was in December, around Christmas. And I remember walking from Jerusalem to Bethlehem on Christmas Eve, which sounds very romantic and biblical, but really it's like a four-lane highway that you walk along. It's not that romantic. But what was interesting about it is that at the time in 99, you couldn't really tell where Jerusalem ended and Bethlehem began. The two cities sort of overlapped. It was only once you started seeing Christmas trees that you realized you had reached Bethlehem. I returned a few years later after the wall had been erected. Now there's no overlap. There's a very clear division, you know, carved in concrete between Jerusalem and Bethlehem. And I remember seeing that wall for the first time kind of in person. Like everyone else, I'd seen photographs in the media and read about it. But to stand in the face of this towering concrete was really staggering and remarkable. And it made me wonder, like, what is it like to actually live in the literal shadow of this wall and other walls like it? So I came back to Canada and started researching not just the wall around the West Bank, but walls that existed in around the world. And was really interested in getting the stories of the people who lived next to them. So yeah, I traveled to 8 different places around the world, 8 different walls. You mentioned Belfast and the West Bank. I was along the Indian-Bangladesh border. I was in the Western Sahara. I was on the U.S.-Mexico border. I was in Cyprus. Even I ended the book in Montreal, you know, where a fence divides a very wealthy neighborhood from a rather poor neighborhood. And so I came home with that particular story. Mm. But, you know, got the stories of the people who live there. Mm. It was really not, the book was not about me. It was about those. I was a collector in that book, collecting the stories of these people who somehow eked out an existence in the shadow of these formidable barriers, met the people who somehow got over, under, or around them, heard some amazing stories from some amazing people.
Mm. Tell me about the divide in Algeria.
The Moroccans and the Sahrawi people have been at war for many years. And during this war, the Moroccans built, each time they pushed back the Sahrawi rebels, they would build a berm out of sand so that the Sahrawi rebels couldn't drive their jeeps and attack. And so they kept building these berms further and further into the desert. And so now there's all these sand walls in the desert. And on the east side of those walls are the Sahrawi refugee camps, which are in Algeria now. Algeria kind of hosts these camps. And I visited those camps in the Sahara in Algeria, and also visited the other side of the wall that's in kind of disputed Moroccan territory.
How did you find Belfast, certainly after everything has ostensibly ended?
Ostensibly. You know, I was there in July where things don't seem to have ended. You know, there was the bonfires and the parades and the riots and everything else in July in Belfast. Belfast struck me more than I thought it would. Because, as you say, things are supposed to be over. The troubles have ended. But the young people in Belfast kind of have inherited that conflict from their dads and uncles. So whereas the previous generation kind of fought with guns and bombs, their sons are now fighting with stones and bottles. And it continues. I mean, there's more interface barriers, is the term now, than there was during the Troubles. And there's more walls in Belfast now. Mm. And I found that very, for lack of a better word, I found it very depressing. And I was never sure, when I was watching these riots and these young men fighting the police in July, and wondering, like, what was it all about? What were they fighting for? And I never got a good answer for that. Mm. You know, and that depressed me. At least I was at demonstrations in Palestine, and regardless of where you stand on that conflict, you can tell what they're fighting for. You know, they have a goal or what they're fighting against. In Belfast, it wasn't as clear. The violence seemed chaotic and random, and it made me very sad.
Then we come to America and the U.S.-Mexico border. Now, of course, we've all heard about Donald Trump's plans for the wall, but there has, in fact, been a barrier there for many years.
Oh, since the 90s. Yeah, at least, you know, there have been barriers there. It was really interesting. You know, I spent a lot of time along that border for the Walls book and met, you know, saw the walls, met people who got over and around them, met people who lived next to them. And then during the U.S. election, all this talk about we're going to build a wall, it seems so strange, you know, because there's been walls there for a long time. The border's not sealed, and it never will be. It's almost physically impossible to do that.
But we're going to build the biggest wall
ever. It's going to be beautiful. It's going to be so beautiful. yeah, so there's barriers already there. And these prototype walls that Trump, that are being proposed, don't look that much different than the walls that are already standing in a lot, along a lot of the border. So it's kind of strange. There's a handful of writers who I call it, we're the walls writers. You know, we all know each other. Most of us are academics. I'm the only one who's not. But we've seen what I've been calling a Trump bump over the past, you know, couple of years, and getting calls from media for us to opine about Trump and his walls plan. And the thing is, we don't have anything new to say. What's going on there has been going on for a while. He's shining a light on it. He's being more stupid about it. But really, this is not a new thing that's going on.
I mean, right back to ancient city walls.
Of course, of course. Yeah. And that's what inspired the Walls book in a way, is that, you know, here we are living in a world that's so connected virtually. There's no walls between us culturally, between us economically, financially. You know, the same music we listen to here in London, they're listening to in Algeria. You know, everything is shared. And even the things that we're afraid of is shared. Terrorism knows no borders. Climate change knows no borders. You know, the swine flu knew no borders. You know, like everything just crosses. And yet, we're building physical walls as, you know, these ancient defense mechanisms that we've been doing since we first could put two stones on top of each other. That remains. And that seems like such a throwback to a less sophisticated humanity.
This brings us on to Song of the Caged Bird, Words as Resistance in Palestine. And this is a book that you brought out in 2014. Really still walls in a way. But talking about Palestinian literature, particularly old Palestinian literature.
Yeah, so I taught at the Palestinian Writers Workshop. I was a writer in residence for a month in the West Bank, and I taught 9 students a nonfiction workshop. I had them write stories from their own personal experience, and I was very curious what these 9 writers, how many of their stories would be about the conflict, how many of the stories would be about the checkpoints and their grandfathers lost olive orchards and this sort of thing. And I was really surprised to find that almost none were. These writers were writing about the things that you and I would write about. They're writing about family politics. They're writing about love and about childhood rebellion and silliness and all this sort of thing. In other words, they were writing very human stories that weren't rooted in politics and struggle. And I thought, well, here's an interesting way maybe to look at the Palestinians is through the lens of their literature. And so it started with that. The Song of the Caged Bird was a short kind of digital book. And I visited some libraries and met some writers. But after that book came out, I realized this was something I wanted to explore much, much further. And that was the seed. The Song of the Caged Bird was the seed material that I then expanded into the new book.
I'm really interested in the kind of historical aspect of this short digital novel, because you talk about the century-old library in Jerusalem. Yeah. Of a family that just goes back centuries.
Yeah, the Khalidi family, they can track their family back to Jerusalem. Yeah, centuries. Some of the original inhabitants of Jerusalem, they would say. This family was very wealthy. They were all like jurors and politicians and mayors, and they were very well-respected, scholarly family, and therefore collected many, many books. And so over the decades, centuries, they started to collect the books into one particular library, which you can visit in the old city. Some gorgeous old gold-inlaid Qurans, and there's an old book that follows Saladin's final battle against the Crusaders. It's handwritten, an account of that battle. There's a book of poisons and antidotes in there as well.
Some what fantastic languages?
Almost all Arabic.
Right.
But the librarians and the caretakers of the library were happy to kind of show you kind of the prize volumes within there. And like everything else in that part of the world, it had to struggle to survive. It was affected by the conflict. The Israelis had taken that library and suggested that they were going to take over the building. And the Khalidi family spent was it 20-some years fighting in the courts to keep that old building, and finally won. They won that battle, and the Halley Library still exists, not without a big fight.
So then on to your latest book, Pay No Heed to the Rockets, which has just come out now, Palestine in the Present Tense. And as you say, the seed of this came from your workshop that you held with these writers. So tell me what happened next.
You know, after coming home from that residency in Palestine, and having met my writers, the writers I worked with, as well as looked at, you know, the Halley Library and a few other different book-related places. Like I said, this was a way to talk about Palestinians and life in Palestine that didn't start with struggle. It didn't start with conflict. And that's what I've been wanting to do for years, to write about Palestinians in a way that comes from a different angle. So the literary lens turned out to be interesting for me, kind of entry point. That way, I didn't have to, when I met people, I didn't have to ask them a political question to start. I can ask them, what was the first poem you wrote? What was the first book you read? You know, did your mother read to you when you were a child? And that was a way to hear the lives of Palestinians from an angle that wasn't just war, conflict, struggle, violence, and prison, all those sorts of things. And it worked for me. I heard some amazing stories. I met some amazing writers and poets and librarians and booksellers whose lives reflect what life is like in Palestine now, but the beauty of it too. I mean, you know, that's another thing I wanted to do was, we don't think of Palestine as a place of beauty. We think of a place of fire and smoke and violence and sadness and trauma and war. But those who've been know that Palestine, not only is it aesthetically beautiful, not only are the hills of the West Bank beautiful, not only, you know, is the desert a beautiful place, not only are the cities and the old cities gorgeous, that the people, they're beautiful people. They're generous and affectionate and welcoming and funny and charming. And I really wanted to paint a picture of Palestine that was beautiful, because I think that's lacking.
Let's hear some of those stories that you uncovered there. I mean, there are so many. I mean, one is about how revolutionary writing is smuggled out of prison.
Yes, some inelegant ways it's smuggled out of prison. I met with a former inmate and visited a library that had books that were collected from prisons in the 1970s and 80s during the First Intifada, when much of the resistance was Marxist and it was lots of socialist thought. And so these men who were in prison used to write out kind of socialist manifestos and handwrite books about and by Karl Marx and these ideas about socialism on the very thin pieces of paper that are peeled from the back of cigarette foil. Those tiny thin bits of paper. And I saw these notes written in the tiniest kind of microfilm hand, like the most kind of beautiful and tiny. And they would smuggle these ideas back and forth, these tiny little papers back and forth, sometimes in books that would have been hollowed out so they can pass around the prison. Sometimes when there were prison transfers, they would encapsulize these tiny bits of paper. They would take the plastic from the cigarette package and wrap it around these tiny bits of paper, melt it, seal it with a lighter or a match, and either swallow it or insert it and pass it from that way to different prisons when there was exchange. And so there's this transfer of ideas and of words, which I think is so interesting. We think of contraband in prison. We think of drugs. We think of weapons. Those First Intifada prisoners, their contraband was ideas and words and notes that they would smuggle back and forth.
Quite extraordinary. Let's talk about the Gallery Café, which is the other extreme, where you've got this huge celebration of intellectuals coming out publicly to celebrate this space.
Oh, the Gallery Café was in Gaza, run by this theater impresario guy named Jamal, who's fantastic. And Jamal had this gathering place where Gaza's artistic class, the writers, the musicians, the intellectuals would gather every day and sit and drink coffee and talk and create and read their poems and sing songs. It was a beautiful, beautiful place. Men and women mixed freely there. After Hamas came into power, Hamas didn't like the Gallery Café. There was too much freedom at the gallery for Hamas's tastes. An ongoing kind of battle between Jamal and Hamas to maintain the gallery. And some of those incidents were almost funny, almost Keystone Cop, kind of ridiculous, and how he had to evade these undercover Hamas agents that everyone knew were Hamas agents. They were poorly disguised. He would be arrested. He was flogged. There was a bomb set up at the entrance of the cafe one night in the middle of the night. So this ongoing battle to keep this space, because in Gaza under Hamas, those spaces are getting fewer and fewer. Those spaces where people can be free and express themselves creatively, places especially where women and men could actually sit at a table together, are becoming less and less. Hamas does not trust these kinds of places. And so Jamal fought kind of for years against Hamas and eventually lost. Hamas eventually bulldozed the cafe, said they were going to build a cancer hospital in the space. And I visited the space. There's no gallery cafe. There's no cancer hospital. There's some goats nibbling on trash in an empty field. But I just recently received a message from Jamal, and he's rebuilding, and there's going to be galleries going to be reborn on the beach sometime soon.
And of course, all of those intellectuals that were there, that were contributing to the life of this space, are still writing.
Yes, of course.
About contemporary Palestinian literature today.
It's in good hands. Palestinians are writing. Their work is being read amongst themselves. Their work is being read abroad.
Because we don't see an awful lot of it in translation.
No, we don't. And there's not a lot of it in translation. I mean, my challenge for writing this book was to find and read as much as I can. I don't read Arabic. So it was finding these translated poems and books, which, was not always easy. I must have Canada's biggest collection of translated Palestinian literature sitting on my desk right now.
Is there a theme, do you think?
You know, there used to be a theme. This is what's interesting that I learned during the writing of this book, was that up until a certain point, Palestinian writers and artists of all kinds, but writers in particular, were really considered to be kind of soldiers of the cause. Their poems were nationalistic and patriotic. They would wave the flag on the page. I always say that every mother in a poem represented Palestine. You know, she was never just a mother. But after Oslo and after the Palestinians really figured that their leadership kind of surrendered any hope of independence to the Oslo Accords, these writers said, we've been wasting our time. We've been wasting our time being nationalist on the page. We've been wasting our time being soldiers. Now we're just going to be writers. And so the writing changed completely. They stopped waving the flag on their page, and they started writing about domestic issues. They started writing about love. They started writing about sex. They started writing about intimacy. Now the mother on the page was just the mother. You know, it wasn't a symbol for something nationalistic. And that's continued. Politics is there. The struggle is there. You can't live in Palestine. You can't be Palestinian without having the occupation affect you on a daily basis. But they don't feel the need or the responsibility to be political overtly on the page anymore. Mm. So you find this very much more nuanced and sophisticated writing and very beautiful. And it serves a political purpose anyway. You know, when we see Palestinians create beauty on the page, then we see them as whole human beings. One of the problems in the West, and maybe I'm speaking as a North American, as a Canadian, is that we only see two kinds of Palestinian. We see the young man with the keffiyeh wrapped around his face throwing a stone, or we see the woman in front of her destroyed building kind of on her knees wailing. Right, we either see militants or victims. Mm. We don't see a whole complete human being. We see a metaphor for struggle. What these writers are doing, and what I hope, if I may be so bold, what my book does, is to show Palestinians as complete human beings who have heart, who have interior lives, who want to travel, who want to fall in love, who yearn to visit Paris, who flirt with the girls in their Arabic studies class, like all those regular things that human beings have, the Palestinians possess. And of course they possess it. It's just that we don't have a chance to see it very often.
Mm. And also writing in that environment where you have all of these problems around you must be very difficult. I mean, for instance, even the daily struggle for electricity.
Especially in Gaza in particular. I mean, the writers that I met there, they're not aiming to publish in kind of the regular traditional way that the publishing industry works. They do what they can to get their stories out. And so a lot of the young writers I met there were publishing their short stories on their Facebook pages. The internet for Palestinians, especially in Gaza, has become like this other Palestinian territory where they can freely express their literature and their ideas in a way that they can't at home. Yes, you know, the 4 hours of electricity a day sometimes in Gaza, and people can't leave. They can't, their lives are so pressured. The fact that they carve out any time at all to write is a miracle.
What about the gender balance within modern Palestinian literature?
I was so pleased to spend so much time with so many amazing female writers when I was there, young and old, women are well represented amongst Palestinian writing. Some of the most interesting writing is coming from women, some young women. I met a teenager in Gaza who publishes short stories on her Facebook page, and the women's writing is very vibrant and quite beautiful. And extra pressures, right? I mean, in Gaza in particular, you know, Hamas is hard on women, and for them to have find a place to express emotion and kind of freedom on the page is very, very important. Mm. There's some beautiful writing from Palestinian women.
I'm really struck by how throughout the book, it seems to me that you are very much trying to put a positive spin on this.
I wouldn't say spin. It's not, and I know this is not what you're, I know you're not accusing me of this, but it's not manufactured. I didn't feel I had to, I'm not twisting anything to express my own personal view. I'm revealing in this book what I experienced firsthand, what the reality is. I have a sympathy towards the Palestinian cause, which is clear from that book and other things that I've written. But I'm showing, what I want to do is show this reality of beauty and art and humanity that does exist. There's no shortage of ugliness and darkness in that book either. You know, every person I talk to, you know, I mentioned earlier on that I can start my conversations with about poetry and reading and writing and beauty. But those conversations very quickly move to politics. And it's politics is always there. That darkness edges everything that's done there. What I just wanted to do is show that there is more than that.
Absolutely. And you've completely opened my eyes, and I'm sure the eyes of all of your readers to that. Pay No Heed to the Rockets is published by Saki Books, and it is written by the wonderful Marcello De Cintio. Thank you so much for coming on to speak to us.
Well, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough, Christy Evans and Stephanie Saikia. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.